This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and with us, our guest, Matthew Thorburn. He is the Witter Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress this year, and he was chosen by Charles Simic, U.S. Poet Laureate. Now we're going to hear what all the celebration's about with an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. This is called Clearing. And here's the clearing, the open space where the river ravels off one smooth finger, and ferns and pockets of shadow pare the light down back beneath the trees. Linger now to hear two silver birds call out too soon, then fly across that second sky, swiftly overlapping on that slow-lapping blue. Between what's going and what's gone, you see that you're alone. The light falls fast, so faint the disappearing trees. Few things last too long, and last things you let slip like so. The river sky dims, the birds, their song, long past. Though you look, look again, till something sings within you, and without that, don't let go.
That is Matthew Thorburn, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. I was telling him that last night at the library where he was celebrated for his fellowship, there was an audible gasp of love after that poem. And that poem is so comforting. Perhaps all art is some reach toward comfort, because it seemed that all of a sudden the audience felt very satisfied to me. Did you get that?
I think a little bit. I mean, it's for me, it's a poem. I mean, it's a sonnet, and so there's a certain, I guess, fulfillment of expectations with the rhymes and with making those all connect. You know, satisfaction for the reader in hearing that, and then satisfaction for me as a writer in being able to make those work. It's a 14-line poem that you have to write a lot more lines, in my case, to find the right 14.
Well, what kind of a tub of melted butter were you in when you wrote that?
It was actually, I had written another sonnet that comes right before it in the book called Long After, and I'd wanted to write a sequel to a poem. I just had sort of, in the abstract, thought that that would be an interesting thing to try to do, because you see it a little bit, but it's not a real common thing as opposed to, you know, in other movies or TV shows or things.
Right, right. Matthew, when Charles called you, how was that? How did that happen?
Actually, I got a letter, and it was sort of funny. I got a letter at work, and I went in one morning on a Monday, and I was the first one in the office and turned on the lights. And in our in-tray, where all the mail comes in, there was this letter. And I don't typically get anything very good at work. It's either inter-office mail or, you know, you're on mailing list, you get junk mail. And I thought, well, what is this mailing? And, what is from the Library of Congress? What would this be? And as I was sort of opening, I thought, well, maybe this is something
my
good.
My book is overdue.
Yeah, something like that. And I just sort of sat there and read it a couple times in sort of a daze. And then I called my wife on the phone and I said, I've got some really big news, and told her
about it.
Was
it completely unexpected?
It was. I think one of the wonderful things about this, there's so many awards and contests and book contests that, you know, you apply to or you know, try to get a grant or something. And this was just totally out of the blue, and I had heard of them, but I didn't really even know too much what it was until I got the letter.
Well, it is wonderful because it's on the merit of your work. And I asked Charles how he chose you, and he had not even met you, maybe in a crowd or something, but he said, I really read the work and I was stunned by the poetry. And as you say, there are so many contests where you need not apply, but it's remarkable. There are so many thousands of poets in America that he should have come across your work, and it just rang the bell with him. So congratulations, you're going to have a great year.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it was a surprise, and it's just very humbling, because I think there's so many poets who I admire. And so to be singled out is
take
is
it and
really...
run. Let's hear another poem. Matthew Thorburn.
All right. This is a poem. There's a number of poems in my book, Subject to Change, and in my new work as well, that are about paintings, either actual paintings or about painters, or in this case, it's just an imagined painting. And this is called Portrait of Former Lovers in the Spare Style of the Past Century. Mm. In the distance, the blue pencil line of a river, something to echo the murmur of a vein along her neck. Because we're in the city, no stars. Just the low, swirling gray of a sky. A rooftop bar, striped umbrellas folded down on the umbrella tables, which suggests rain has come and gone, and overhead hangs the moon like a poorly wound clock. Let me explain.
Mm-hmm.
She's just told him something which hurts because it may be true. And now she's turned her face away. So all you get is the flare of her cheek. Less paint here, zinc white, a touch of canvas showing through. So you must read this in his. Because she's already too far away, or has decided she is. The glass he holds blurs with perspiration, a wedge of lime sunk down in there. And what's happened to the keening clarinet, the upright piano, that song we might sing once more? She hums something else from not long ago, while he looks for all the world, like he'd like to say, a hint of yellow round the eyes fallow blue. What's not meant to hurt, hurts most. Though, to tell the truth, what's meant to hurt, hurts too.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Give us another one. I'm building up an attitude.
Oh, great, great. This is another painter poem. This is about a number of actual paintings. A few years ago in New York, I just kind of happened to go into an exhibit in an office building in Midtown, some paintings by Fairfield Porter, who did a lot of work in the mid-20th century out on Long Island back when it was, I guess, still mostly sort of rural farmland, which is sort of hard to imagine now, but it was sort of a rustic setting. And he did a lot of work out there. So I looked at a number of paintings and sort of described them in this poem and have written in sort of my imagining of his voice. And I should say, too, that he was a big fan of Wallace Stevens, so there's an echo of a famous Stevens line in here. Fairfield Porter, potato farms and hay fields, and the green and yellow spill of trees were what I found here. The island was very, very dry that summer, and the grass turned the color of the rock. This is how light works. Elaine de Kooning in orange and a muddy brown jackety thing on the floral print couch. A smattering of flowers, just smudges, really. Blips of white, yellow, pink against the shore. Then the lighter patch of light on my hair. The twin pinpoints of white in Catherine's eyes. And here, the clean gleam of our Adirondack chairs. White on white, sitting over their shadows on the lawn. And on the table, an open bottle, a glass. I placed a half-filled glass in Southampton, and the island rose around that glass. The studio, Anne in the doorway, come to see me, and out the window the pink and purple Canterbury bells and foxglove. Jimmy planted those. Do you recognize the morning harbor's pink, cerulean, pale orange? It was always clear to me this tree outside my studio was only 8 strokes of white touched with gray. So I painted it that way.
The sensory evidence in your poem, in all of your poems, are, I guess, the strongest quality that you have. I was thinking you enter the poem through the senses, and Hopper would be happy to do a painting on a poem of yours instead of, as you do, a poem from a painting. I was just thinking, what a Hopper painting could be made out of those Adirondack chairs and the light on them. Which is the Wallace Stevens line?
It's his poem about he placed a jar in Tennessee. And it's this idea of a glass. There actually is a painting that Porter had done of, and it's got the chairs, and I think there's a glass on the table. And I thought, sort of like in the Stevens poem, I guess, there's a way in which this world that's in his painting sort of revolves around this glass, or sort of this sort of sense of leisure or this certain lifestyle.
Perfect. Living in New York, do you capitalize on all the visual arts in order to fuel your poems?
I try to. I mean, I'm a big fan of a lot of painters. Like I say, painting comes into it. I think in a way, you know, I was one of those things I wanted to do and never really did was to be a painter, I suppose, although I never pursued
it. That's what's coming
out. But so there's a real affinity and kind of an envy there of an art where you can, I guess, to really just sort of show, not that it's this simple, but sort of show things how they are.
And
I
try to be.
Well, I try to be
visual. You do paint a poem.
Well,
it is painterly. This is Matthew Thorne Byrne, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is a book which is available, and I think you should get it, Subject to Change. It is New Issues?
Yep,
yes,
New Issues Press.
Poetry and Prose, and that comes out of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you came out of Michigan.
I did as well, yes. Products of Michigan.
And this has gotten some wonderful remarks, Angela Ball says that this book, Subject to Change, gives us a poetry of the meta-empirical, asking, it's not too late, is it? Exuberant and crystalline, these poems articulate the problematic beauty of our grand mix-up, our new and comic dark ages. And this is true. You do some unpredictable things in the middle of a poem, and you do almost, your timing is almost like comedic timing sometimes. And when we come to it, I'll point it out, but let's come to it.
Okay,
this
great.
This is Matthew, and I'm Grace.
Thanks. This is another poem. Maybe this is in the vein you're talking about. It's called For Friends Who Are Married and Expecting More Babies. The secret to cucumber soup is wasabi and ice cubes, the yin-yang of hot-cold. You mean peppery hot, not hot-hot, right? Yogurt for consistency and a little sugar. Eat it from a mug in the yard, weather permitting, or under the overhang, checking out a low-res sunset like this one. We can just make it out through a static that's equal parts breeze and wet leaves on the trees. Should we drink fruity drinks, something with limes, say, garnished with paper umbrellas, before we go splashing off rubber-booted across the stream? Not us. We drink simple beers with whiskey in between. A little whiskey slakes the thirst, but then it makes you thirsty for a little whiskey. You know you're the only person I know with your name? Lucky you. Now only the darkness can tell us about the darkness. And only my stubbly chin, rough as the head of a match, can speak to the question of laziness. If you screw A into hole C by way of washer B, you will be one step closer to happiness. Let me give you a for instance. Is everything always something else for you? So I won't mention this last band of light, pink like the pink half inch of panty I glimpse when you stretch, yawn, stretch, or the number two pencil you borrow to pin up your hair. What is it with me and this small stuff anyway? I staple in quotes anything you say so it will stay. What about those for instances? I count them off on my fingers. For instance, sometimes things fall into place just so you can hear them click. For instance, when I say you, I mean you. For instance, the dark taste of fennel on the wet little heart of your tongue.
There we are. It's the philosophical and a little borscht belt thrown in.
Thanks.
It's the wryness, you have fun. You have fun while you're writing it. But wait a minute, I forgot to ask you way back in the other poem, who was Jimmy who planted the flowers?
Oh, I should have explained. Fairfield Porter was friends with a lot of other painters and poets in that time. And that was actually the poet James Schuyler, who lived with the Porters for a while. And so he's mentioned in there. And then it also mentions Anne, who's Anne Porter, his wife, who was a wonderful poet. And Catherine was his daughter.
But it's nice to just sprinkle Jimmy in the middle of a poem like a little bunch of blue flowers in the middle of a field. It really doesn't matter who he was. I was just curious.
Oh, yeah.
Matthew
yeah.
is reading from Subject to Change, and we're examining his mind. And he's not coming up lacking at all. Let's hear another one because, first of all, have you been told that you read pretty well?
Oh, thank you. Thank
but
you.
Have you ever thought of yourself as a performer?
Not too much. I mean, I know as someone who's, one of the things I've done in New York is go to a lot of poetry readings. And the one piece of good advice I got was just that you couldn't read too slowly. And I find as a listener, I find some people read too fast. And
that's interesting.
And you really have to be able to hear it. So I just try to read slowly mainly.
You can't read too slowly.
The little secret. I forget who said that, but I thought it was really just spot on advice.
Good advice. Go ahead, Matthew.
Okay.
Read slowly to us.
This is another poem kind of in that same vein. And I can't remember exactly how this came about, but I had this idea that there's a number of people, like you said, with James Schuyler or different people who appear in the poems. Well, I guess in a way I just wish I had known or people you would like to meet if you had been around at those times. And I had been reading Gertrude Stein and her prose poems, which are just sort of from another world.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know where this idea came from, that it would be interesting if you knew her and took a walk, and what would it be like to talk to her in sort of like her everyday voice, as opposed to the sort of stylized voice of the prose poems. And so this is called A Walk Through Chinatown with Gertrude Stein. What I remember is you talked so plainly. those ducks in the window, so red. And of the sky, not blue, but maybe not yellow, or maybe pink, perhaps pink, but simply doesn't look like rain. We passed a hot dog cart, and you confessed, I'd like to try a Snapple. Camouflaged in silver wig and blue sunglasses, you were almost someone else. If anybody thinks I'm anybody, they'll think I'm Andy Warhol, you assured me. As we walked down Little Fuzo, as we turned onto Canal Street, I think you kissed my cheek. I know you took my arm, the way my great-grandmother, my other Gert, used to, and told me you wished you had written something with dim sum in it. We stopped to watch the three-card Monty dealer, but couldn't spy his never-to-be-seen Red Queen. Where's the lady? Where's the lady? You echoed. We laughed. We walked on. A man tried to sell you a gold watch out of a briefcase, and you bought it. I know, I know, I know. But fake gold is still my favorite gold, because it doesn't last forever. Later you bought me Chinese bubble gum, yourself a red dragon finger puppet, and an I Love New York t-shirt for Alice. We said we'd chew on chicken feet before we said goodbye. We never said goodbye. And for you I picked out a snow globe with a yellow taxi in it that had come unglued and floats upside down in the snow.
Are those love poems?
I guess in a way. I mean, it's sort of like a I wish I knew you kind of poem, or a sort of an expression of affection, I guess.
One thing that Charles Simic said when introducing you last night was that he liked poets who read everything and know everything. And I was wondering how human knowledge, just a body of knowledge, helps you as a poet.
I think I haven't read everything, and I feel like if anything, there's so much I haven't read, but I try to read as much as I can, and I always keep a notebook and find that the useful thing for me is just to write down everything I think of as soon as I can or as soon as I think of it. And then some of those things, you know, will be useful sometimes years later. There's one poem I read just the other night that had a detail in it from a friend's life, and I'd actually forgotten where it came from, and he said, you know, you remember that was me. And it was from years ago, and it had just sort of lodged in my head and became useful in a poetry respect in the certain poem, you know, quite a few years later.
Well, my husband accuses me of stealing everything he says, and he wants a footnote for every remark that winds up in a poem.
Well, I've had that happen, too, where a friend had told me something, and I used it in a poem, and he said, you know, I was going to write a poem about that.
Oh, no, I never.
So I try to be careful.
Actually, if it's another poet, I would never take anything they think or say.
Well, that's good
because
advice.
Because we know they're going to use it at some point. Let's hear some more. This is Matthew Thorburn, okay. New Witter-Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress.
Thank you. This is a love poem of a kind, and this is sort of a... Another thing, I guess, besides wishing I was a painter, is that I wish I had stuck with the year of piano lessons that I took as a kid and been able to be a musician as well.
You can all still do it. You're so young.
Well, I should.
You can do everything.
I should. But this is a poem that was actually inspired by the music of this group of old Cuban musicians called the Buena Vista Social Club that was very popular about, you know, back in the 90s, I think. And this comes from a couple of their songs. It's called Candela. And it's sort of set in my imagining of Cuba. In the street, the boys play the dumbek. They play the timbales and the conga. I sit on the stoop with Margarita and the falling sun and restring my guitar. A brown dog sleeps in the shade. I had 5 sons here and named them Juan. I had a daughter and named her Juanita. I have a nephew named Kampai who was lost and brought home by the dogs. Now Margarita reads my poem. This line is for luck. This one means always money in your pocket. This one is for honesty. Can you see that it's crooked? Because he grows deaf, Margarita's father, who lives upstairs, must put his ear to the piano lid to feel each note he plays. Sunlight streams through the window, broken only by the head of a boy who has climbed the roof to look in at his grandfather. Now Kampai and Tula are together in the waist-high weeds. He wishes to unbutton her dress, but she says, everything is like a fairy tale to you. You were brought home by the dogs. He rests his hands on her waist and wishes to dance. Kampai works in the tobacco fields with the 2 oldest Juans, then comes home at night to sing at the Casa de la Trova. He wears his cowboy hat so all will know he is a countryman. He wants to take Tula to her room, but she wishes to be taken to Santiago. At night he sings, I work without rest so I can marry, and then I'll be a happy man. Juanita plays the harmonico. Juan, her brother, sings, Tula's bedroom is on fire. Come, Kampai, bring a bucket of water to put out her flames. Tonight we eat black beans, corizo, the green fruit each Juan calls by a different name. As for me, how I came to Candela, I do not remember. Margarita says I wandered here beneath the stars. The stars like pieces of tin. The stars like the silver buttons on Tula's dress, which Kampai cannot touch. She laughs. Above us, my father-in-law plays the song with two names. Margarita says I am the bull that disappeared into the river. Now no one will drink from it. When I die, each of my wands will sprinkle rum on my resting place.
Matthew, where did you get that dialogue?
It's mostly just things that I made up. There's a little bit, the part about Tula's bedroom being on fire is from a song that's on their CD.
The line, you were brought home with the dogs, that is extraordinary. That's a good rejection.
Oh, thanks.
A very good rejection. And that just popped into your head?
Some of it. I mean, one process that I use a lot is to sort of, not exactly free write, but to just sort of, I call it sketching, but actually using like a little digital recorder and sort of talk the poems and then transcribe it. And then there's a lot of rounds of, you know, revising and compacting and finding the pieces that fit together. But it's sort of a process, almost of collage for me. And so this was, I think, a poem.
You always do this?
Not always. And lately I've actually been gone back to a sort of a more traditional narrative writing. But for some of this book and then for most of my second manuscript, it was more of a collage process.
Because it's
together.
Such an arduous thing to have so many steps to have to transcribe it. I find there's so many steps there to do that is a little bit daunting.
It is a little cumbersome.
Trouble.
The only benefit I found is just that in speaking the lines rather than typing, I can type pretty fast, but I still sort of feel there's a certain formality maybe
You're
to typing. And speaking it, I was able to just sort of, you know, kind of give it more off the cuff and sometimes come up with things that maybe I wouldn't have taken the time to type or that may not have come out.
Your poems articulate very much, almost like there's a playwright in you. The Social Club was a film, wasn't it?
Well, it was a group. I'm not sure how the project started exactly, but it was sort of bringing together this group of musicians who I think were very, very famous in
yeah,
Cuba. We're not really known outside of the country.
Actually did.
And they made a documentary, you're right.
Right.
It's a great film to track down on DVD.
I would like to see that again,
yeah.
Because I now feel that the characters, have you added characters?
I took a little bit from their songs, those lines, and a couple of details from the musicians' biographies, like the one person said that he wore his hat. It was sort of like a symbol of being from the country.
I love the woman who wants to go to Santiago.
Oh,
this is the book Subject to Change, and you can get that by, I guess, just going on the internet. That's the way we get everything. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and that's Matthew. He's our new Witterbinner Fellow. And what will you do with this privilege? I think that there's a little task involved.
There is. We have to give two readings. One we just gave yesterday at the Library of Congress, and then myself and the other fellow for this year, Monica Ewan. We're both from New York, so I think we're going to do a reading, not in the city, but hopefully up in New York State somewhere.
Oh, that would be so wonderful.
So, yeah,
together.
It would be great. It was really fun to read together last night, and so to read again would be...
Had you ever met her?
A great treat. I hadn't met her. I actually heard her read a year or two ago in the city, and it was a great surprise to find out that she was the other person, because I liked her poems a lot.
Well, let's hear some more of yours.
Sure. This is a poem that, as I said, I'm from Michigan, and this is takes place in the city where I grew up, which is the capital city, Lansing, Michigan, and is a poem about going home to visit. And sort of being in between two places, I guess. It's called In Lansing. Black coffee for starters, and sun sneaking through a scribble of cloud. Holidays over, and still in from out east. You and me, Kay, and cold, day-old light. Dishwater or thereabouts. And pale, the sky through these trees. Blue that's almost not blue. A bird's egg, or as if colors were verbs. Oranging, bluing. And you hadn't said blue. Who loves January? You see the steeple, but the bell's still broken, half shined with ice. And someone has to unplug and take down these tangled strings of lights. Get the hose to spray the salt off the Buick. three fingers of grass show up through the snow. This is hope. They're brown and yellow, dying or dead. Couldn't we cover all this more happily in a kitcheny little still life? Freckled bananas, fuzzy cheek of a peach, the colander and the cheese grater and the cheese. Any waxy red wheel will do. But already you've got that look, like wherever you are, you wish you're someplace else, though specific or otherwise you don't say. I say, I love how snow falls on gray snow. And at night, you can see the stars here. But really, how long do you want to look at stars? If you say it and say it and say it, even happy sounds meaningless, or sad, or sorry, or sublime. My favorite word is now. No, now my favorite word is the one you're about to say. Wish is a funny word, you say, pouring coffee. You don't hear it much anymore. Must be we all got what we wanted.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Matthew was selected by Brenda Hillman for this book. Apparently it was a competition and she was the judge.
Yeah, it was a first book contest.
Wow. And he is, in addition to being a recipient of this fellowship, he has also been honored with the Mississippi Review Prize and then two Hopwood Awards from the University of Michigan and the Belfast Poetry Festival's inaugural Festivo Prize. Belfast?
That's Belfast, Maine, I should say.
Oh, his poems have been in prestigious magazines such as the Paris Review. Was Charles Simic the editor?
He was.
At that time?
Yes.
And so perhaps that's how he came across your work and many other periodicals. Graduate of the University of Michigan and the MFA program at the New School. Was Ashbery there then?
No.
Oh, who taught you poetry?
I worked there with David Lehman. And Laurie Sheck, who's a wonderful teacher and poet.
And now he is doing something that doesn't sound too poetic, business development writer, but for the international law firm. So maybe you have a little creativity going on.
Well, it's a little bit. I mean, they're sort of two different things. It's a wonderful day job, and which is sort of creative in its own way.
But all of us have to write work other than poetry. I truly believe that. The poets laureate are chosen because of their expertise in prose, essays, and the broad spectrum of writing in addition to poetry. I mean, I've never seen a laureate here who didn't have those other faculties of other kinds of writing.
I think it does all go together. And I mean, I think you have different hopes for a poem lasting in a way that, for instance, in my job, I write for the website, which is very, you know, very ephemeral, or for the firm's brochures or new business materials, which are more, you know, have a much
technical,
shorter lifespan
and
technical. But I think it does come together. And like you said, there's a certain...
Writers write. You know, writers write. That's it. And your new book is called Like Luck.
Yeah.
But we're staying on with this one for a bit, and then we'll go to new poems.
Okay, great. This is one of the last poems in the book. And this is another one with some musical elements to it. In fact, the title is Refrain. The dogs run ahead, barking up crows, as you bring up the rear, a shotgun balanced in the crook of your arm, heading back to the water. This afternoon you thought it a sign of getting older, this diminishing interest in the details of a thing. Your face in the mirror, say, with its tight wrinkles in the upper lip, or the perfect fit of all the tiny pieces of your watch. You find yourself wanting things to work without you having to know the how or why. Now the dogs are lying in the grass, their tails still. There's a samurai philosophy in this you're trying to master. Refrain until you can respond instead of react. Or look before you leap. That works too. And here's one more. Count your blessings. You're still alive because you were late and missed your flight. It happens to the best of us, which would later go down in the cold waters off Prince Edward Island without you. Or you lost four fingers to the circular saw. Again, it happens. It happens. But the doctor sewed three back on, and they work. Here at the water's edge, beneath the trees' crooked wings, the things that warm the mush of your heart seem beyond explanation. The way a good night of drinking in Hoboken ended years ago, with you pissing between parked cars, just before one you'd thought empty, there for the night, churned to life and pulled away from the curb. How is it these things you think most beautiful? The green-headed marsh ducks dabbling, upending themselves in the still waters of Lake Au Sable, are the very things you've come to kill. Don't worry over the past. Even if you can't remember the refrain to this scrap of a song as it courses through your head, floating back now from a time you long for, or even work yourself back to who it was that was singing. Remember the kangaroo, that funny, deep-pocketed marsupial, can't jump backwards either.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Matthew Thorburn. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back with you. The Library of Congress with Matthew Thorburn, new Witterbinner Fellow at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're talking to Matthew about his methodology, his work, and how he gets where he is. Do you find that there are subjective symbols in your work that crop up here and there? I mean, when I look at a whole bunch of my poems, I think, oh, I do say that a lot. You know, there are light,
definitely.
For instance, light is a big thing with you.
Well, that's actually, it's funny because that's exactly what I was going to say. And it's sort of a discovery for me because this book and also my second manuscript are sort of, at least started out as sort of the old-fashioned, you know, collection of individual poems rather than a book project or something with an explicit, theme or conceit behind it. But I did find as I was putting them together and looking at which poems might fit together or go in a certain order, that there are these things that I come back to, and light would be one.
Colors, painting
and music. And I think definitely, I think everyone probably, the more you write, you see that there's these certain obsessions, one person call them, or preoccupations that you kind of come back to.
We know what you can do well. What do you have to compromise in yourself to do it well? What do you have to give up?
In terms of poetry?
In terms of the process, I can think of too many words being a thing that we have to give up. But there's always a point where we have to sacrifice something. What is it with you?
Probably, I mean, that's one thing I think is trying to get everything in as far as details and, you know, sort of picking what are the telling details. I've been reading a lot of Elizabeth Bishop and Philip Larkin, who I think are two people who are excellent examples of someone who can pick, Larkin can give that one detail that sort of, you know, evokes this whole world or this whole person. And the same thing with Bishop, or the way that sort of the details accrue or come together. And so that's something that I think is a challenge oftentimes, is sort of what things can you cut away? Because someone, I think Charles Simic actually said that, you know, like sort of the ideal poem aspires to a kind of silence. And I think it's like, how much can you take away and still have really sort of the essence of what you're trying to get at?
Are you happy with what you do, or do you go back and are you the kind that kvetches and says, oh, I wish I hadn't put that last line in? Or are you pretty, you go forward?
Well, I think, I mean, I would say so far so good. I mean, this book came out in 2004 and I've been reading from it pretty regularly since then. And there's nothing, at this point, there's nothing that I wince at or really wish I'd done differently.
I mean,
partly maybe because I know in the process of writing, I do a lot of revision. And it takes a long time before I feel that something's done. So then hopefully once I reach that point, then it's really done. Or at a certain point, I think it's, to go back to it, it's like you're not really a different person, but it's like you've sort of gone past the window of when you're sort of in the place to work on that poem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Let's hear more.
Okay. This is the last poem in the book, and it's another musical title. It's called Coda, Where the River Runs. What comes in music? What comes in the light in light brown eyes? A flicker of light in brown eyes. What comes back? The cello's wavery rubato. This string of a song. The lovers falling into one another. Oh and oh. Shaped by sadness. By what stays close for going unsaid. How the heart seizes. grips, then lets go. Where the river runs over the rocks, where the black tern hovers over inland marshes, the light grinds down to a dusky glow. Quiet, quiet. Even if my heart wallops in my chest like a fish in a bucket, and there's nothing I can say to make it stop.
I was thinking about the concrete thought in that poem and then how you transcend it. And I think it's with your, the where is a lot helpful getting you where you need to go, the word where. And there's certain ways you move that poem along that lifts it up off telling a story and transcends telling that story. Can you help us with what words they might be?
Sure, sure. I think definitely you're right. I mean, that repetition of where is kind of a hinge word. This poem is actually a good example of what I was saying before about having certain things in mind or things you've written in your notebook that you're sort of waiting to be able to use. And a couple of things came into this, that closing image of the fish in the bucket.
I love it.
Is one of these things.
Yeah.
I have a few things like this where I've put it into a lot of different poems and it never really fits. I'm like, all right, I got to take that back.
I'm going to use that fish yet.
Yeah, I'm sort of dying to use this. And so that is where it sort of clicked into place. But yeah, definitely that repetition of where and what. And I was trying to do, I guess here, sort of trying to do something that, like you say, sort of tells us a little bit of a story without being sort of explicitly narrative or even using full sentences, but just sort of giving these little glimpses and little fragments.
That's it, the phrases, that's what does it. Transpersonal writing, yes, above the actual. Well, tell us then about your new work and how different or how like it is. Are you in a whole different world?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's similar. It was, some of it was written in a different way, I'll say, but I like when you're talking about preoccupations of light and color, and there's a lot of stuff in this new manuscript, Like Luck, which is about painting, and actually the last section of the book, I think the last four or five poems all specifically mention light and are concerned with light. So that really comes together. But it's sort of different in terms, I guess, of process. A few years ago, a friend of mine, the poet Jay Leeming, had taken up the habit of writing a poem every morning. And he had sort of challenged me to write a poem a day for a year, which I did. And there's a whole tradition of this with, you know, William Stafford wrote every morning. And Robert Bly has one of my favorite books of his is called Morning Poems, the poems he wrote every morning in bed. And David Lehman, who I worked with at the New School, has a couple of books of poems he wrote every day. And so I took Jay up on this challenge and I got one of those sort of day at a glance books and tried to write a poem, or at least write a rough draft every day. And I found that really helped me to be very kind of on alert always to what could be a poem or anything that had promise to it. And also to kind of let my guard down as far as like an internal editor and to sort of be open to any idea, not reject anything, because I have to write something. And that was very useful to me to sort of to let all that in and just be sort of kind of to go with it. And so I think the poems, as well as being written in that sort of collage style, but I think they have a little more of an associational quality and are, I think, a little looser and maybe a little more free-flowing, at least from my point of view, that seems to be the case.
And the title?
The title is Like Luck, which is actually... is just a phrase in one of the poems. I sort of read through it a few times and it was something that popped out. And there is sort of an element of luck, not so much as gambling, but sort of a feeling lucky or feeling like things have kind of come together, whether it's in love or in just sort of seeing these things that come into this poem or whatever it might be, sort of that sense of kind of just I'm in the right place at the right time.
Well, there's a beautiful, sweet quality about your writing where it's an upbeat writing. Although there's always lurking loss because light can't stay, even light. Any of your images are perishable so that it's not a Pollyanna thing. But there's a lot of joy and a lot of acceptance of life in your work. Has anyone ever said that to you?
Oh, yeah, I think definitely. And I feel that. I mean, it's for me, a lot of poetry or what sort of feels like something I want to put into a poem is kind of that sort of being in the moment or catching the moment. I read it in an interview, Philip Larkin said, you know, that to him, I think he thought that poems were basically a way of taking some experience that he'd had and making it available to the reader to recreate it and so that they could experience it when they read the poem. And so I think there's a certain amount of that kind of like catching the moment. And I think some of that sort of sense of loss is sort of a feeling of nostalgia and kind of wanting to be able to re-experience that myself. Although the poems are generally not, you know, sort of straight from life, but certain elements of it that are sort of autobiographical.
That's true.
And so here's a poem. This is the opening poem in the manuscript. And this is sort of a case of something being, I guess, inspired by real life events, but then it's sort of an imaginative departure from there. This poem takes place during the evening commute from Midtown Manhattan, where I work at a law firm, out to Astoria, Queens, where I used to live, going by subway. And this is called Horn of Plenty. Like this paper horn of flowers tipped across an arm, I'm jostled, poked with it. It's how happiness happens here in the subway. Asters to zinnias and violets, deep oranges, crenellated yellow and cream, the faint brushwork of baby's breath, miscellaneous greens, and I'm off now, past the turnstile, the stairs, and into Astoria. How's this cornucopia work? One thing plus another, and repeat. Say a boy in a red suit with a birdcage on one side, a cat on the other. Like the boy is blonde, the suit too short. And what's in the cage? Where'd that cat go? But that's Goya. Try Gershwin. This is Steinway Street. Let's say everything green. These ladies' saris, mint green, sunlit against the black green, deckled green hedge. High in the tea green trees, each green nest awaits a green bird. Or like the coffee clatch of sparrows outside my window. Each morning they file this reminder. You're human. You're human. And everything else I can't shoehorn in here, piled up like the fish, pale pink and dark pink, stacked row upon row in this fishmonger's ice, beneath the swirly, frothy cherry blossoms. I'd let it go, almost. I would, almost all of it now, to have what's next, right here, what just makes it into my eye. That flicker, this watery light, that bit of distant tinsel the magpie drops everything for.
The moment, that's certainly an example of it. Interesting form there, where it is, unlike some of the other work you do, it's pretty much, it looks like a narrative, a straight narrative poem, but it doesn't sound that way. And I think there is, because in the line, there's a lot of lyricism within the line. I mean, if I look at that across the table, It looks pretty prosy.
Yeah, it's pretty much just one sort of column of fairly short lines.
But that's not the way it is. Because within, there's sprung vowels within the line. And that's surprising to me. If I hadn't seen it there, I wouldn't have known that's the way it looked.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting, yeah. Well, definitely, I mean, I write very much by ear. I mean, like I said, with the recorder, but also just also revising out loud. And I don't really do, the first, in Subject to Change, there's a number of sonnets, and there's a sestina and some more formal work. And this book is pretty much all just sort of free form with just a couple of exceptions. But I do try to, you know, sort of get those internal rhymes or sort of write something that sort of sounds good to my ear.
This is Like Luck, which might be on the shelf with luck.
Hopefully.
With luck?
Hopefully.
Next year, maybe.
This is another poem that's also set in Astoria. I lived there for about 3 years, and it was during those 3 years that I did that poem a day year. So a lot of the work, one of the things I like about it is that it sort of takes me back to living there, and it has that sort of daily life kind of feel to it of my daily life at that time. And this is a poem that describes Astoria, but also is sort of addressed to a poet who I read and never met, but who I sort of wish I had known, Tom Andrews, who's a really amazing poet and died quite young and only has a couple of books that have been collected, I think, by Oberlin Press. It was really wonderful, wonderful, amazing stuff. And so this is called Homage to Tom Andrews. The birds break and wheel, fall out of, back into their loose weave wave. Define a falling arc. They fall like dark water, or like a chain of dark molecules that ripples and falls like water. How they dis and re and disorder themselves, then do it again, altered almost imperceptibly this time by an anxious cabbie's beep beep. Gray birds, gray sky, one more dirty daily miracle I hold out to you. Dear Tom, how's heaven? Here in Astoria, it's January, month of the two-faced God, and I look both ways before crossing the street to reach this better vantage point. Here, beneath a flashing orange hand, not a wave, but a warning. There must be a formula to account for these wheels and arcs, these waves. A how, if one has the patience, needs the proof. if beauty is, again, not enough, even in Queens. If we keep wishing for a story, a song, some lovelier way to say what happens, then deeper down let us find a why, and further still, its echo, a why not that makes this music. Till then, Tom, I won't let anyone ask me why I'm trying so hard not to forget they're just pigeons, but to forget that word just.
You're a sequel poet, so we should have a poem from Tom telling how heaven is.
Well, I'd love to read that poem.
I'd love you to write it.
Okay, I'll take that assignment.
Really, how's, dear Tom, how's heaven? Wouldn't we love to know?
Yeah, well, it's just kind of, I mean, it's sort of a funny thing with this or with the poem about Gertrude Stein. I mean, it's people that I, you know, of course, I never knew, but you sort of feel like you know people when you read them or
I'm
wish
gonna
you
look
did.
Him up.
He is really, really someone I couldn't recommend more highly. As I said, there's a number of poems in here about paintings and about painters, and there's three poems that are called self-portraits, and they're all sort of, I guess, sort of playfully self-portraits because I'm sort of off to the side or the painter or the writer isn't actually in them. And then also a couple of the poems mention and refer to the painter Pierre Bonnard, who's someone I like a lot. And this poem addresses him sort of halfway through. So this is called Self-Portrait with Unmentionables. A nubbly pink throw rug breaks up the butter-colored tiles. Avocado toilet and towels. And here are the telltale glamour and Cosmo peeking out from under the Kleenex box atop the toilet tank. Oh, shimmery shower curtain, mauve, salmon, jammed to one side. Bernard, you'd be happy here. Closer up, the green neon of the mouthwash. A squiggle of cinnamon floss pokes out of its plastic case. All this framed in the gold-framed mirror I see now, along the top of which steam evaporates, so it only takes another second to figure out I've only just missed her. And make out the many whites, pale pearl and eggshell, sea salt, saltine, hung up to drip dry, the flimsiest of whimsies, her briefs and bras.
Those whites are out of sight.
Oh, thank you.
Like it. The saltines, those whites.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, I tried a lot of different, you know, you said try a lot of different whites.
We threw away a lot of whites.
Yeah, there was a lot of time on that recorder saying different whites to find those.
Half shined with ice. I still remember that from your last book.
Oh, thanks.
Half shined with ice. You have a lot of shiny things.
Well, I think, as I said, the light, and as I was putting this manuscript together and you sort of find the poems you want and start to weed things out, it sort of hits you over the head how much, for me, how much light is in all of these poems. And I guess it's something, I think now if I write anything with light in, I'm very aware of it. At the time, I didn't really realize, I don't think.
But that's what painting is, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's you know, it's sort of, we couldn't see without light, so. Yeah, so I guess it makes sense.
Tell us another story.
Sure. This is another little poem, and this was from that Poem a Day project. My wife and I took a driving trip for a week, just sort of poking around up in Cape Cod during the off-season and checking out different things. And there's, in one of the, I think it's a state park there are three old wooden lighthouses that used to be on the shore and in service years ago. And I think as the shore was eroding, they had to save them. They had to pick them up and move them. And so now they're on display, so you can see them, but they're way inland in this park. And there's sort of this odd place where you walk into this field, and there's three lighthouses, and then they're sort of surrounded by trees. And that's actually longer than the poem, but they're called the Three Sisters. And so this poem is called Three Sisters. Not Chekhov's, but Nauset's, three wooden lighthouses, moved inland in 1911, and out of service, so they wouldn't topple over with the eroding coastal shelf and wind up in the water, now stand out here in a field, this pocket of yellow grass tucked away in the woods, so that I can only imagine their lights, which have long since been turned off, sweeping across the leaves that wave in the trees to warn the ships, which are not there, not to wander in too close to the rocks, which are not here.
There is a little mischief in you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think this is something else that Charlie said somewhere, but it's that that, you know, poetry kind of takes from all these things. Right? So it can be, you know, sort of jokes and paintings and stories and mythology, and it's like a little bit of everything can kind of come into it. And so I definitely like that. If there's opportunity to
little stand
to
up,
make a little humor, sure,
a little light.
That's maybe another career I wish I'd pursued. This is another poem that has, I guess, some humor in it. And this was also from that poem a day. I think about a third of this book probably started out in that year of trying to write something every day. And this poem came up when I was waiting on a subway platform with my wife for a train, and there was a group of college students just down the platform from us. And one lady was telling a story, and she was had sort of that verbal tic that a lot of us have, and that I do sometimes, where we'll say the word like a lot.
Oh.
You know, say I was like this, and he was like, oh my God, and so forth. And I thought, you know, sort of trying to find a poem anywhere I could that might be something to play with. And so this is called "And Nadine Was Like." A flea that hops from dog to dog. And Wendy was like, cherubic is just a nicer way to say fat. And Len was like the drain down which you pour the tail ends of old liqueurs, Blue Moon, quince schnapps. Then Naoko was like, who threw this party anyway? And Susie was like, I hate to say it, but I'm all sushied out. But Fred was like, let's dance. But Sylvia was like a typewriter in a crowd of computers. And Jill was like a man who asks his wife for a divorce the day after an earthquake. But Sal was like, now is asks really quite right? And Bob and Bill were the red banners strung up and down Mott Street that say Happy New Year again and again. But Betty was like spaghetti stuck to the wall. Then Jill sneezed and sneezed, like a phone that rings and rings, that rings but doesn't get picked up. And she was like, we all have so much to let go of. And Fred chimed in, we're lonely, even though we have cell phones. But Ty was like a magnet, made of metal, highly charged. And Joan was like winter, but with all her leaves still on. Then Sylvia was like a peck on the cheek and a peek down the blouse. And Naoko was like that blouse. And Jane was like the clock that turns back just once a year. Tick-tock, tick-tock. Where'd the time go this time? But I can't forget Lily. Lily like a wisp, like a whisper. Lily like the fish the fisherman missed. Slippery, silvery. Here and not here. Now here. No, here. I fell for her. And then I was like the fall. And she was like the maple leaf rag the blind pianist played that made us stop and close our eyes.
The nice thing about that is at the end you really surrender and admit like as a simile and use it as a simile. And that's, in other words, you take it and dignify it after you were kind of playing with it all along and use it very respectably at the end.
Oh, thanks. Well, I tried to, you know, try to sort of get a turn in there somewhere because I thought you can only kind of go so far with sort of the jokes and the playfulness. And then.
But tell us about how mean you are, the divorce after the earthquake.
Oh.
I mean, how mean is that?
That was, I don't know
where
that came
that come from.
From?
I mean, that's as bad as it gets.
Yeah. I think that may have been in a short story I read. I'm trying to think where some things, you know, you sort of try to remember where they came from. But yeah, I wouldn't want to be in that situation.
But the like thing is really serious. I mean, it's pandemic.
I was with
young college people, very smart people. Every word is like. I'm really frightened about it. Well, that and no problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it doesn't really go away. I mean, like I said, I find myself using it. And so I sort of felt comfortable sort of making fun of it and playing with it a little bit because it's something that I suffer from.
You're
too.
Guilty of.
Sure, sure.
Matthew and Grace. And we have time for a couple more.
Okay, great. This is another poem from the book, and it's another musical poem. It's called Fred Pegg's Didgeridoo. Not the real deal. Eucalyptus hollowed by termites. Scouted out in the outback, the aboriginal way, after a long night of tapping on trunks to find the right kind of thick. Then debarked, cleaned and marked and tuned, who knows just how. But a stretch of PVC tube taller than him, striped with duct tape, he hauled around like a prophet's staff, a liberated downspout. Bamboo trumpet, Webster says, getting it exactly wrong for once. Even if Fred trumpeted like an angry elephant, rolled out a foghorn drone to send me packing, or, then again, lead me home. My didge, Fred said, as if that explained everything. though even before he fit the name to the thing, the name itself was music, fit for my ears, and those of the first man and woman, so the story goes, back in the outback again, to conjure every beast and bird they'd need to populate the world, that hum going on and on and on, all the animals gathered round, wide-eyed, like, well, now what? With the right puffs of breath, he might rouse the spirit of what moves us and leaves no tracks. But not so fast. It takes months to get just the breathing right. For now, farts and grunts, a waspy buzz, awkward as a lost whale, immodest as a gassy kangaroo, some local yokel rolling over, groaning in bed, waking the wife. Shh, it's 3 a.m. in West Virginia. Even the standing cows have drifted off. Go back to sleep now, dear, she says into the dark. It's just a dream you're dreaming.
But you're dreaming it in perfect three-line stanzas,
yes.
I see. We have time for one long poem, two short poems, or the story of your life.
All right. Why don't I'll read the last poem for you that's in this manuscript, and it's the other poem that is about Pierre Bonnard, the French painter. And it's kind of an in-between length, so maybe that'll be good. It's called Every Possible Blue. And I should say, too, it starts with a story that's somewhat well-known about him, that he is someone, when we talked about revision, who would actually go sneak into galleries and touch up or keep working on his paintings, that he had a hard time feeling that they were done, which is sort of a fascinating story, but if you know Bonnard's work, it's pretty widely told. So this is called Every Possible Blue. That he would go back after hours to retouch the ones hanging in the gallery. He must have had an in with the guards. To get it righter, if never right, you've heard before. How he'd revisit the light, bring it up or turn it down, just as I have returned to this morning all afternoon. They make me hungry, these two pairs he must have hurried to paint so she could eat. A few green ideas about grapes. The apple shows off its high, bald head. To be fascinated by fruit. Not fruit, but light. Imperfect mirrors, imitation mirrors. His broken pinks and reds, green and yellow model. This dash of white, no light, no canvas showing through. I almost catch my face there, looking back. I know this fruit. I've eaten it all my life, though this basket's new to me. A few brown twists of vine, uncertain transport, but I'm moved. I'll say that, made to speak. Such tenderness, his abiding affection for anything touched by light. And he needed so little. A few pieces of fruit, a window, the sky trying on every possible blue.
And the basket is new to you.
Yes.
That is the voice of Matthew Thorburn. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media with post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. We wish to thank the Witter Binner Foundation for funding the series and The Word Works, which presents poetry programs and has since 1975 in Washington, D.C. We thank heartily the Library of Congress for its assistance and support. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.